Welcome to the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Furthering the public's understanding of gambling and casinos with a mix of lectures and conversations available 24/7 to the world online.
Today is August 11th, 2010. This is Dave Schwartz. I am talking via telephone with Joseph Mazur, who has written a book called What's Luck Got to Do with It? About gambling and luck. And Dr. Mazur is Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at Marlborough College and is acclaimed in the field. He's a Guggenheim Fellow, and they don't give those out too easily, and has written a number of really good and important books about math. So, Professor Mazur, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you first got interested in math?
Yeah, well, it's a combination of events. My brother was a child prodigy in math. He got his PhD at 19 and had no other degrees. He didn't even get a high school diploma, but went straight for the PhD and got it at 19. So I didn't want to follow in those footsteps, even though I was pretty good at math. But for my 15th birthday, he was about he's 4 years older than I am. And for my 15th birthday, he gave me two books as a present. One was Crime and Punishment, and the other was a modern algebra book. I remember them so vividly because I devoured the Crime and Punishment. Mm-hmm. The modern algebra really was trouble for me. But I definitely wanted to understand it, and I struggled with it. For him, the two books were pretty much the same, and he could read the modern algebra book just like he could read the Crime and Punishment. But then I went off to an adventure in the Venezuelan jungle, and I met another mathematician, and he somehow influenced me to start to ask questions about mathematics. And then when I went to college, I enrolled as an architecture student, and this is what my father wanted me to be. I didn't like it when I was a student, and I went off to Paris to because I felt that I needed more math, and I didn't have enough math, and I took math classes at the University of Paris and never returned to architecture. So I got my degree in math and then went on to get my PhD. So that's basically how I got involved in math.
So how did writing books, especially books for the more popular market, start for you? How did that, was this influenced by your time in the classroom?
Oh, very definitely, yeah. I've been teaching at Marlborough College ever since I got my PhD back in 1972. And there's something special about Marlborough because the courses tend to be interdisciplinary. So there are tutorials and courses, and the students, they have to write theses in their last 2 years. So you learn a great deal from students who come to you and they say, I want to know about this or that, and even though I would hesitate most often thinking that I don't know anything about this field, by the end of their thesis writing, I would learn from them what the subject was about and some details on the subject as well. And Marlborough is also special in that I could teach courses in other areas than just simply math, but sticking somewhat in the realm of math. So the history of math, history of science, philosophy of math, and the courses and tutorials would... those are courses and tutorials I've never been able to teach elsewhere, I think. Mm-hmm. And it allowed me to think very broadly and not to be afraid to explore areas outside my immediate expertise. So that's basically the teaching at Marlborough, at Marlborough really influenced the way I would write books, because they my books tend to be very broadly designed.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is important, because when you're talking about trying to get people excited about ideas, I think in some ways there's a lack of generalists, people who can really communicate stuff.
Yeah, when, for example, the What's Love Got to Do with It book, mm-hmm. in that case, I thought of writing about the mathematics of luck, the mathematics of gambling, and then it occurred to me, well, wait a second, to really understand luck, I'd have to broaden that and talk a little bit about the history of gambling, and then I still didn't understand it myself, and I decided, well, you know, let's think about the psychology of gambling. It's basically the only book that I know of that deals with those three aspects of what luck is.
Mm-hmm. It does do a really good job of bringing in the history, the math, and the psychology.
Well, thank
you. So kind of the question I have is, how did you get interested in writing about this topic of luck?
Well, again, many, many reasons. Luck is one of those, it's one of the most common words used in the English language. If you Google luck, you'll get millions and millions of entries. But as a mathematician, I often get asked about luck in response to odds or coincidence, statistics, probability, and gambling. And it's also one of the most mysterious concepts. One of the most misunderstood, one of the most challenging. And I wanted to understand it myself, and that's why I had to tackle the history, the math, and the psychology all together. But let me tell you why now?
Mm-hmm.
Why after all these years of writing other books and teaching other courses, why did I want to attack it now? Well, my family background included gamblers. My father was wasn't a full-time gambler, but he lost his paycheck every week. My uncles were gamblers. My grandfather was a gambler. Bookies used to come to the house. This was back to the days when all gambling was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And, I remember going to collect money at in sleazy places, and I remember the bookies coming to our house and my being afraid that my uncle's knuckles were going to be broken if they didn't pay up. So that's one reason why I've always been interested in this. But the more immediate thing was that I was stuck at a 7-Eleven one winter night, and my car broke down. And it was getting to closing time. It was about 11 or 12 at night. And, well, 7-Eleven doesn't close, but this wasn't quite a 7-Eleven.
Mm-hmm.
It was about to close, but the Powerball lottery was up to the many, many, many millions. I'd forgotten how many, but mm-hmm. it was quite high. And one after another, people who probably couldn't afford it would come down, come in, and plop down a $50 bill or a $100 bill, and just buy lottery tickets as if they were buying milk for their children. You know, it occurred to me that I should somehow explain to people the nature of gambling and putting money that you can't afford to lose on lottery tickets. And then I drove off, and I thought about it, and I decided to write this book. But then it occurred to me, when I got into the book, I decided not to sermonize about it, because I began to see other things in gambling that I would not have seen had I not written the book.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. So just kind of a random question here. Do you have any theories about why people get so much more excited about the possibility of winning $100 million at maybe 100 million to one odds as opposed to winning $10 million?
Isn't that amazing?
Because you figure they would both be life-changing jackpots. Why do you think they get so much more excited about the higher jackpot that's left.
I think it could be explainable through possibly media hype as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, surely, you know, most people would be very happy with $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to win $10,000 would be would make your day, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they won't bet on a $10,000 lottery ticket. They'd prefer to do something that was much, much higher. But of course, there are other people who will buy lots of lottery tickets thinking that they can corner the odds on at least two or three of the six numbers by buying lots of lottery tickets. So there are many people who do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're thinking, well, you know, I'm playing the game, well, at least perhaps get my money back and maybe win a few dollars on the side. The problem is that most people, as you know, most people don't tally their losses. They,
mm-hmm.
they forget about their losses and they only tally their wins. So, but it's a curious question, and I've thought about it a lot, and I just don't really know the answer. It's a serious question for psychologists. I have no idea what the serious answer is.
Yeah. So, having studied the history of gambling, what do you think, what are some of the more interesting things that you came across that you maybe hadn't been aware of before you started the project?
Ah. Well, the most surprising thing to me is that there was essentially no mathematics of gambling before the 16th century. I mean, that is strikingly surprising because, you know, why didn't the Greeks, for example, who are so aware of everything else in the world, think that, in fact, that there is a mathematics for chance as well as a mathematics for, you know, for almost anything else. And it's really surprising that this comes so late. I mean, why didn't gamblers just simply count? You know,
mm-hmm.
because if you start counting, you begin to realize that there's a mathematics behind this, and it's not all attributed to the gods.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I mean, the earliest document I know of is Galileo, who actually tabulated the number of possible sevens you could get with three. Well, actually, he did it with three, but it'd be simpler to just count it with two die. You know, there are more possibilities for seven to occur than one or two. So with that knowledge, you begin to think, well, wait a second, there is something in the mathematics that is telling me what the odds should be. Of course, they had no notion of odds itself, but that's a striking surprise. I mean, I'm bewildered by it because there had been earlier theories of gambling. There had been notions of gambling and even books written about gambling earlier, but nothing that was substantially mathematical. I mean, there's no probability, for example, before the 17th century, a little bit in Galileo, because he's starting to understand this. But it's really the 17th century, mid-17th century, that all of this starts to occur. And before that, you know, gambling's not a business. You don't really have casinos that can rely on profits, because they don't know how to calculate the profits.
Mm-hmm.
It's all chance. After the 17th century, you begin to get kind of the coffee houses and the clubs and the places that become the casinos, where they have a business model.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they know that if they can attract a certain number of people, that they will walk away with a certain profit, depending on the volume of people that they get. That's the striking thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, in addition to the history, you cover the mathematics very well, and I think do a very good job of explaining it to people who aren't math majors or former math majors.
Thank you. Yeah.
So, what do you think are maybe the top one or two common mathematical fallacies about gambling? You already talked about cornering the market and lottery tickets. What are some other ones?
Well, I think it's the misunderstanding of randomness, and that comes out with the hot hands fallacy. You know, the Amos Tversky, who was a psychologist who studied the Philadelphia 76ers and compared the pairs of shots of this basketball team with just random pairs of shots and realized that, in fact, there is this thing that he called the hot hands fallacy. That is the wheel really hot if in, let's say, 25 spins of the wheel, five reds come up in a row, or even 10 reds come up in a row? People begin to believe that, in fact, that because you see the same number or the same color coming up repeatedly, that there's something wrong with randomness. And we know, of course, in a long string of digits, let's say from 1 to 9, five may come up 16 times in a row out of 100 times, mm-hmm. And one can predict that it will. But the novice gambler will see that as a contradiction of randomness. That is to say, they'll think, well, it's not random, and therefore something is hot. So the wheel, for example, it would be hot if it comes up red more times than they think it should. And so they think, well, red is hot, let me bet on red. Then another group of people will say, well, wait a second, black must be due. So you get a whole different kind of behavioral approach to how you're going to gamble, depending on whether you believe whether you're a hot hands person or you're my turn is due kind of person. So it's really a misunderstanding of randomness itself. I mean, which goes into all sorts of things. I mean, think about the recent issue, which is the Bulgarian lottery. Dave, you know about this one, mm-hmm. that in the Bulgarian lottery, the number came up, the jackpot number, that is picking 6 out of 42, came up twice, the same number, 4 days after the first, 4 days apart. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, the Bulgarian government thought, oh, wait a second, something's wrong, it's fixed. But when they investigated it, they realized that, in fact, you know, coincidences do happen. It's a whole other book, actually, to talk about coincidences. But yes, coincidences do happen. And so one should not be surprised at those things. You know, there's this woman who, Joan, I've forgotten her last name, but the woman who just won a lottery 4 times in her, well, mm-hmm. Over a couple of years, I think, but she mm-hmm. won 4 jackpots in Texas, and she won a total of about $21 million in these jackpots. She happened to be a retired mathematician, by the way, and mm-hmm. one doesn't really know quite how she did it. My guess is that she was buying lots of lottery tickets and dealing with some schemes that she had in mind. I tried calling her to find out more about it, but she doesn't answer her phone. So
interesting. So does this have to do with the law of large numbers? What you're talking about, the people's understanding of randomness?
Yes. It does have to do with the law of large numbers. The law of large numbers, it's not really about gambling itself. Mm-hmm. It's more for the casino to understand the law of large numbers than the gambler.
So what should casino executives know about this?
About the law of large numbers? Oh, they know a lot about it because it is the predictive scheme mm-hmm. to tell the casino if they get the volume, the likelihood of their getting profits can be predicted. In other words, it's not what we call the law of averages, which doesn't really exist. The law of averages for the non-mathematician would be something like this. You flip a coin 100 times, you would expect it to be to come out heads half the time. That's not really what the law says. What the law says is that Well, let me put it this way. Here's the mathematical side of the law.
Okay.
You've got, if you flip a coin, you know the probability that the coin will land on heads is a half. Mm-hmm. That is, if you flip it and you're talking about the mathematical probability. So the mathematical probability is what the ideal coin will do. But then there's the observed probability. So there's the thing you're actually going to experience, which is, well, you expect it to be around a half, but it's not necessarily going to be a half. The probability is going to be something else. Now, what the law of large numbers tells you is, more precisely, is that that if you repeat your events a large number of times, then the likelihood that the likelihood gets larger, gets more certain,
mm-hmm.
That the difference between the mathematical probability and the observed probability will be more negligible.
Okay.
So in other words, you've got these two kinds of probabilities. One is the mathematical one, one's the observed. You want them to be as close as could possibly happen. You want the difference to be close to zero. And the mistake that most people make about the law of large numbers is the mistake is that the more you, the more events that are in the sample, you, the more events that are in the sample, the more likely, well, the more it will actually be closer to, the observed probability will be closer to the mathematical probability. But what actually happens is that all you get is a likelihood that that will happen.
Okay.
And the likelihood gets better with the increased number of events that happen. So it's a little bit more complicated than what people think. But surely the casinos bank on this because all they have to do is get the volume of customers into play. And you can calculate your profits on that.
Yeah, some of the work I've been doing lately is looking at hold percentages and how they change, and there's certainly a lot of volatility for games like Baccarat,
mm-hmm.
which are there are smaller numbers of people gambling a lot more money.
Yeah.
So the volatility is just really a lot bigger. And kind of the most surprising thing I found was that blackjack, which has the biggest skill element, has had the lowest fluctuation in hold percentage.
Well, but doesn't the blackjack have a lot of volume?
That's the key. It
yeah.
does. So that kind of proves it right there.
That's it, right?
Yeah. So there's empirical proof.
Yeah.
So most people have to know that the odds are against them when they walk into a casino.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you think people still like to gamble so much?
Well, they're flirting with the unknown. They're flirting with the unknown future, I should say, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a human desire to take control of destiny. I mean, that's just the way we are. We really, religion is based somewhat on that. I mean, we really mm-hmm. believe you want to believe in the afterlife even, and that sort of thing. It's just something in our nature that we want to do, and we want to take control of it. There's the Freudian side of it, which would be, there's the collective subconscious of human phylogeny.
mm-hmm.
There's something going on there. And, I'm not suggesting that that's actually true. We're beginning to see that Freud was not right about a lot of things. But there is some element of truth in that, too. As you put it in your book, Roll the Bones, that there is this pleasure at the satisfaction coming from those primal impulses of risk-taking, going back to when we were living in caves and having to go out in the hunt for food. I mean, we're programmed to do this because otherwise we'd be sitting in the cave starving.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is all proven, by the way, by the modern, second half of the 20th century PET scans that now show that the ventral tegmental areas of the brain light up to release dopamine. Those are the neurotransmitters that that excite the areas of the brain that gives us pleasure. And with that pleasure, we have memory, and we remember that pleasure. And, you know, if we get that pleasure, I mean, for example, if I eat chocolate, I have a great pleasure in eating chocolate. I confess that I do. And I have a memory of eating chocolate, and every once in a while I think, you know, it'd be nice to have another piece of chocolate. Gambling, I think, is somewhat like that. You know, there is a pleasure in this excitement. You know, it's an exciting, you know, the excitement is that we are betting on knowing something about our destiny or the future. And, you know, at the end of a horse race, just as the horses are coming in, you get quite excited. I don't see how you could sit still in a situation like that, even if you're not betting on a horse. You just still are very excited. So there's something going on in the psyche that really compels us to get pleasure from this. The danger, of course, is that for people who are risk takers and who have other kinds of addictions, you know, all addictions seem to come from the same area of the brain, that is the nucleus accumbens, where we really begin to think, you know, we remember the pleasure we had and therefore we want to repeat it. And so the repeat, without controls of that, we become addicted to whatever we're doing. And there's where the danger lies.
Mm-hmm. So another thing you talked about, which I think is very interesting to people, especially people who might be gamblers, is how people distinguish between skill and luck. And you talk about how people might not be as good at doing this as they think they are. Can you share a little bit of that?
Yeah. Skill and luck. Gee, well, most people understand the difference. You know, at least in their rational moods, they do. Even people who understand don't always act about caring for that distinction. But the problem is the will to distinguish. We want to believe that there is a skill involved as well as a luck. And yet we sometimes find skill in some of the most surprising places. I mean, you know, you throw the dice in craps, mm-hmm. and there are quite a few people who have, you know, have practiced the throwing of the dice so well that they really believe that they can alter the outcome by how they are tossing the die. And I think that in some cases that's true. You know, I talk about in the book the case where a statistician has built a machine that can flip a penny untold number of times. You can flip it 100 times, 1,000 times, and it'll always come out heads.
Hmm.
And then he adjusts the machine, takes the same penny, and he can flip it 1,000 times, and it'll always come out tails.
Wow.
And what that proves is that, in fact, what we think of as random behavior, that is, what's actually happening when we flip the coin. Well, you know, what we ate for breakfast might determine how the coin is going to land, or what kind of slight wind is in the air at that moment, or, you know, what butterfly flapped its wings a mile away. That kind of thing. We think that that's what it is, but really it is the physics of the coin and nothing else, and we misunderstand randomness there too. So, you know, it's, and even in roulette, you know, some people, they know the odds and payback for placing bets, so therefore there's a skill involved there as well. I interviewed many slot aficionados who claim skill in slots. You know, Remember, all those people who used to think that the lever was key when we had the one on bandits,
mm-hmm.
and people believe that the spinning icons are determined by the mechanics of the reels.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all you have to do is look, and you can see that, in fact, the minute you push the button on the machine, the number is determined already because it's a computer that's determining it.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, completely determined. And the wheel is just following some kind of a mechanism that's telling it to stop on the number that's already been chosen.
Mm-hmm.
But people believe that certain machines are due as well. And so there's a confusion there about, you know, what is the difference between luck and skill. There's all sorts of things like that discussed in the book, actually.
Yeah, and I think one of the real strengths of the book is that it's not dry the way a lot of strictly academic stuff would be. You use a lot of examples that people would know from popular culture, and one of my favorite ones is where you talk about the show Deal or No Deal, trying to explain how people look at risk and luck. Could you share a little bit of that with us?
Yeah, Deal or No Deal is studied by clinical psychologists to find the answer to exactly that question. What is the measure of risk and luck, and how people think of risk and luck? But the problem with studying it through Deal or No Deal is that the contestants are profiled. They're profiled for risk aversion. And risk aversion candidates are filtered.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to get, you, Dave, or I will never be on that show because all the contestants are risk seekers, and we see some very interesting psychology of gambling behavior from them. They believe in luck, and they ignore risk. And they all want an audience. They want fame.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing that comes into... I talk about this in many other aspects. For example, even in the fictional characters that I bring in the book, like the Dostoevsky's gambler,
mm-hmm.
the grandmother, who is very much against gambling in the beginning of the book,
mm-hmm.
she turns out to be a fame seeker. And all of this is, you know, suddenly she is... she's winning, and she finds herself in a situation that is, you know, she's never been in before, and people are looking up to her, and they're smiling at her, and suddenly this invalid old woman is in her element of fame, and so she bets more and more and more. So this is, and in Deal or No Deal, going back to Deal or No Deal, they. Contestants generally lose control of reason. Sometimes they have a break in the show, and some of these contestants have been interviewed. The break in the show, they go, I don't know whether they go back into their hotel room and take a nap or whatever they do, but they think about it. And they've been interviewed, and they tell the story of, many of them have told the same story. They said, you know, when I get back, I'm going to take the deal. And the deal is pretty good, usually.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take the deal. But when they get on the show, there's a large audience of people, and then there's millions of viewers. And they get hooked on this fame element, and they think, well, let me keep it going a little bit more. I really need this to keep going. And they lose control of reason, and that even though they said to themselves, "I'm going to take the deal and not go on,"
mm-hmm.
they still don't take the deal when they get back to the show. So, and also they ignore expected value.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that I don't know whether they can compute it or not. That doesn't matter whether they can, but they could sort of get a sense of expected value, surely. Even though the banker's offers are never really the expected value until toward the end, because the producers of the show want the show to go on.
Yeah.
So the banker's offer is in the beginning quite a bit less than the expected value, and then it sort of verges toward the expected value at the end, and it gets pretty close, and if not in actual, gets to be expected value. And all these people are weak in making decisions for themselves, so they all look to others, and of course when you look to the audience, the audience also wants the show to keep going, and they're going to, you know, root for you to not take the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, everybody misunderstands their chances.
Yeah. So I thought that was a really interesting way of making it very understandable for people.
Yeah. I thought so too.
Yeah. So writing every book is a journey. And I'm kind of curious about how writing the book changed. Did it change the way you see gambling?
Oh, yes, very much. The most significant way is that I see gambling for its entertainment value, and I didn't see it that way before. Before, I saw it only for its grip on addictive behavior, because that's where I came from. And, you know, I saw how it ruined my father and how it, it gripped my uncles, and it was not a good sight when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see it for any other value, but I certainly didn't see the entertainment side of it. Even though I knew it was exciting, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a time when I wanted to sermonize because of my father's paychecks going down the drain. And I thought, well, people with addictive tendencies and propensities for risk behavior should take care. And so I thought that that's what I really should be writing about. And I still believe that, like all people who have addictive tendencies, they should not gamble at all, because mm-hmm. if you gamble just a little bit, just like an alcoholic, there's the same addictive behavior that can come out of it. And I just think that what I learned is that, yeah, okay, there is a small percentage, I don't know whether it's small or not, because it's about 1.5% is what I say in the book, but people who are problem gamblers. Because I didn't sermonize, I began to see other things, other values for gambling. And of course, you know, if you win on a day that something else happened to you, for example, you win on a horse when you lost your job, you feel better.
Yeah.
Or you root for a team and you bet on a team and you win, you feel better about some things that you might have been gloomy about before. So yeah, I did learn a lot from investigating gambling more.
Yeah. So now that this book is out, what are you working on next?
Well, I wish I could say sequels in the works, because I've learned so much about gambling, and not just the history, but the behavior. In the back of my mind, I'd like to write about what I learned from people asking questions about this. Mm-hmm. You know, about what's luck got to do with it, because I've gotten a lot of questions from other people who read the book and people who asked me about the book from other interviews. And I have several other projects on the back burner that will keep me busy for the next 2 years. So I have a memoir that I'd like to finish, and I've been dabbling with it for a couple of years now, and I have not really made any great headway on it. I have a story about a young girl who hated math and then came to an excellent teacher at an inner-city school in the Bronx, and I'm finishing that story, and I think that's going to be a really nice story, too. And then I have a book that I'm planning. I'm still in the research stages of a book on symbols, symbols and math and literature together. So, in other words, the whole question of what is this archetypal kind of thing that we see when we see a symbol, and what happens in the brain when we see a symbol. So, it's a kind of another connection between math and and something else in literature. Usually when I write books, the reason I write books is that I get disturbed by something. Mm-hmm. And I get so disturbed by it that I decide to write an article about it, and the article never stays an article. It always ends up being a tome. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't write books just for the sake of writing books. I don't write books because I have a need to write. I have a need to investigate something that I'm curious about, but on the kind of disturbing curiosity. So, for example, the What's Luck Got to Do with It really came out of, you know, one of the things I didn't say is that I never really understood, even though I taught statistics many times, I never really understood the law of large numbers before. I mean, I thought it was the most bizarre thing in the world, and it really is. I mean, here's a mathematical theorem that you can actually prove, and yet it has a phenomenological aspect of it that really tells us something about the real world. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, you know, how do you prove something about the future? This is the only theorem I know that actually has some connection to proving something about the future. That's phenomenal. And so that's something I forgot to tell you about, but I was really disturbed by it, and I had to know more about it. That's another reason I wrote this book, What's Luck Got to Do with It?
Great. Well, that's really, thanks for shedding light on this, and thanks so much for taking the time. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I hope everybody goes out and reads What's Luck Got to Do with It by Joseph Mazur.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dave. This is a real pleasure having me here.
Hey, great. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, David.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
This has been the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Center, UNLV, its faculty, staff, or benefactors. For more information, please see us on the web at gaming.unlv.edu.